This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Well, good evening. I'm Mark Schumacher. I'm the chief for the Division of Pain Medicine here at UCSF, and it's my pleasure to welcome you, many of you, back for our sixth and final installment in this lecture series on pain and pain management. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Ramo Naidu, who is an assistant professor with us in the Department of Anesthesia and Perioperative Care, as well as in the Division of Pain Medicine. He also serves multiple roles. He's our director of acute pain services, as well as the chair of the UCSF's Pain Management Committee. He also serves other clinical roles, as well as attending at our UCSF Pain Management Center. He comes to us with an extensive background, as well as in global health. He completed a Fulbright scholarship as part of his medical degree at the University of Wisconsin, as well as then went on and did his residency in anesthesiology at the University of Washington, Seattle. He came to UCSF not so long ago, but completed a fellowship in pain medicine here at UCSF. We were fortunate to retain Ramo as a faculty member, and it's been fantastic. He will be approaching a topic that really is both a personal challenge and also a national interest. Certainly, I brought along a copy of the Times. This is from several weeks ago, but it would seem that almost on a daily basis, the topic of opioid-induced side effects and really an epidemic of opioid abuse and unintended consequences of their use are in the news. And beyond the national interest, we have our personal sort of questions, I think, that will be addressed hopefully this evening. One, where are we now with this? How did we get here? And hopefully, Dr. Naidu will approach the topic of, is there a safe and ethical and effective way forward to address the proper management of the millions of people that suffer the disabling consequences of severe pain? Ramo, thank you.
Thank you, Mark, for the introduction. And thank you all for being here tonight. So how many of you think we are in the midst of a prescription opioid epidemic? Raise your hands. All right. Do any of you think to yourselves, well, is the word epidemic a little bit overblown for what's going on? Does anyone think I think of epidemic for infectious diseases or only or when millions of people are dying and it's spreading across the world? Well, I was thinking about that myself, and clearly even in the last week, if not the last few years, I'm sure you open up any newspaper wherever you're from, and you're seeing this term epidemic, and I was always thinking, well, is this just the media, sensationalizing this problem? Clearly, as a pain physician, I know it's a problem, but should we be using the term epidemic? You can see it everywhere. And I started thinking about this because actually when I was doing my Fulbright scholarship, I was a communicable disease fellow, and an epidemic for me was purely about infectious diseases. And so can you name some epidemics, just besides obviously the opioid epidemic, which we're going to talk about? Just name some epidemics you can think of from the past here, or even recent ones.
Flu.
Ebola. AIDS. Ebola. Exactly. Anyone think of something more recent? Maybe you don't think of it as an epidemic yet, or maybe you do. Zika. Yeah. So that's been hitting, a lot of the media lately. And if we think about Zika just in the last, several months here, actually, not too many deaths associated with it, but it's affecting thousands of people, obviously, and there's this association with microcephaly. Going back a couple years, someone mentioned Ebola. We know that certainly thousands of people died. The death rate was significant. It crossed the ocean. Going back even further to SARS, we can see the numbers of deaths and the death rate. HIV/AIDS, 39 million people. Going back to 1959 worldwide, and you might look at that death rate and go, 50%? It's not that high, but worldwide it is, obviously not in this country. And then someone mentioned flu, the mother of all epidemics or pandemics even. 75 million people, the death rate of 2.5%, quite significant. I don't think anyone questions that these were all epidemics for different reasons. So where do opioids come in? If we just look at the year 2014, of all opioids, there were 28,600 related deaths in America alone. The death rate of about 9 in 100,000 people. Now, if you go back for the last 17 years, just opioid-related deaths equaled 165,000 approximately. So a pretty significant number, but where does it compare to the other things? So, like, let's take alcohol, for example. Actually, just in 2014 alone, there were 88,000 deaths associated with it. And smoking, 480,000 deaths. So why are we calling this an opioid epidemic when it pales in comparison to these other things? The reason is this chart right here. If we look back the last 15 years, and these are statistics from the CDC, and you probably have seen these in your newspapers or online. If you look at all opioids year after year after year in the last 15 years, it's just been constantly increasing. And even when the whistles started going off and the bells started going off in 2007, 2009, 2010, those numbers still went up. We thought maybe around 2009, 2010, with methadone coming down and maybe a little dip, hey, maybe we're plateauing, maybe we're getting a little bit better. No, we're not, definitely not. And this is the most latest data to come from the CDC. And some of you might be thinking, well, hasn't our population increased over that period of time? Well, when you look at the death rate, the number of deaths per 100,000 Americans, it too has been going up quite significantly. This is the highest death rate we've seen related to poisonings ever in our country. And I just read an article yesterday saying that this death rate, it almost matches what HIV/AIDS was at its peak, 9 in 100,000 people, which is pretty significant. So where do these numbers come from? They come from the National Vital Statistics System. It's a mortality file. And the way this is obtained is how death certificates are filed. So obviously there can be a bit of a fudge factor in that a coroner or someone or a physician has to file a death certificate. And there can be many diagnoses. Obviously, when one dies, it's not usually just from one cause. There could be a number. And so getting this information is a little bit tenuous. But what's most important are the trends, not so much the numbers, because they're obviously using the same methodology year over year. And you can look this up publicly yourself using CDC Wonder. And I emailed the CDC personally just to figure out how we can get these data. And they were kind enough to give me their spreadsheet. And these are the codes they use, the ICD-10 codes, in case you're interested, the fine print. So where does the term epidemic come from? Epi, among or above, demos, the people. The CDC describes it or defines it as an increase, often sudden, in number of cases of a disease above what is normally expected in that population, in that area. If you look at Oxford dictionaries, they have two definitions. One is that infectious disease definition, a widespread occurrence of an infectious disease in a community at a particular time, which I think many people relate to or think of when they think of an epidemic. And then the second one is interesting because that's why we're calling this an epidemic, a sudden, widespread occurrence of a particular undesirable phenomenon. And that is why we truly are in an opioid epidemic. So how are people dying? You probably have seen the stories. You probably have heard the stories, whether they're taking an illicit opioid or a prescribed opioid. Maybe they get sedated. Maybe they go off to bed and they don't wake up. They have respiratory depression, their arterial carbon dioxide increases, they're no longer breathing, they're no longer oxygenating, and they're found blue. And you might think that's the only way that people are dying, but there are other ways, of course, trauma, suicide, in rare instances, an arrhythmia from certain types of opioids. If you're a heroin user, you might get infectious complications like sepsis or bloodborne pathogens, which may not immediately lead to death, but over time. And we're so focused right now on the mortality, but we have to keep in mind there's a significant amount of morbidity associated with this problem. There might be 28,000 deaths, but there are probably 10 or 100 times more people affected, right, which we'll get into some of the numbers. And so obviously the psychiatric morbidity, the addiction with heroin claiming to be the most addictive substance, and I'll show you some data to support that, suicidal ideation, depression, anxiety, financial stress. If you are addicted, keeping up that habit can be quite costly. And then the physical consequences, the withdrawals, the hyperalgesia, which is increased sensitivity to pain and constipation. And you might think, some of you, I think of a heroin junkie, 20 years ago, you might create some stereotypes of what they look like. Let me tell you, this epidemic that we're in right now, you cannot figure out who those people are. They look like your friendly next door neighbor. They look like the college quarterback for the football team, the cheerleader, whatever. Whatever stereotype you had before is broken. Here are just some faces of people who have gone through this. I recommend checking out this Frontline Chasing Heroin just aired a few weeks ago. It's an excellent hour-long episode on kind of tracking the interplay between heroin and prescribed opioids and some of the stories associated with it. So obviously we prescribe opioids legally, and then we have this heroin issue, which is illegal. But let me tell you, the lines are very blurred. You have people calling doctors drug dealers, and you have people calling drug dealers their healers. It's very interesting what we're in right now. I made the prescribed opioid circle much larger because that's where a greater number of the deaths are compared to the illicit, the illegal opioid. But think about what happens in between. If you run out on opioid or your doctor decides, you know what, this is too risky, I'm going to stop this. No, you're not going to get any more. Well, what might they turn to? Well, they might go to the street. They might go to the street and get heroin, but they might go to the street and get any of the drugs any physician orders. They're going out there and getting fentanyl, morphine, hydromorphone, any drug you can think of, they might be getting it illicitly. And so the interplay between prescribed opioid and illicit is very, very blurred. And then, of course, healthcare providers to drug dealers. You've heard the stories before, you know, the pill mills, et cetera. You can look on YouTube. There's a story called the OxyContin Express about how physicians just give hundreds of pills of OxyContin or certain types of pain medications just to make money and to get patients high and to do whatever else. But obviously, those are rare exceptions. Those are certainly not most physicians, but they're out there. And if you look at where patients who do abuse drugs for non-medical uses get their drugs, it's not from illegal ways. It's not from buying on the street or stealing. Actually, a majority just get it from a friend or a relative for free. More than half. And some will get it from more than one physician, sure, and some will buy it from a friend. But maybe 10 to 20% is buying it from a drug dealer or stealing it. A majority of patients are just getting it because it's available. It's in their community, whether someone had a surgery and had a lot of leftover opioids, they're able to get them. And the CDC makes it very clear, and they've been tracking this for a while, the more opioids that are prescribed in a certain geographic area, the more deaths there are. Now, this is an association, but you can create that cause and effect. I can basically overlay this one map over the other. The top one is just about prescription opioids, numbers. You can see Washington State, Oregon, Nevada, for example. And on the bottom is the drug overdose death rate. You know, can almost overlay the maps. So the more opioids there are that are prescribed, even though maybe it's not your patient that's going to end up dead, it's going out to the community. It's going out to their family, their friends, and maybe out to the street. And I can recommend this book, Dreamland, by Sam Quiñones. I started reading it a few months ago when I was preparing for this talk. It's fantastic. This is one of the paraphrased chapters very early on in the book, and I really liked it. It basically says Sam calls it the silent epidemic, and it says someone obtains access to an opioid, whether legally or illegally, and they abuse an opioid. It's illegal or illicit, so they keep quiet. And when they die, the family is embarrassed. They don't want anyone else to know about it. They might even lie about why they died. So they keep quiet. And the numbers over time increase and increase. No one wants to talk about this issue. Obviously, now we are. I think, you know, even this week, the national discourse has significantly changed. And now we are talking about this. But 5 years ago, 10 years ago, not so much. Well, is this a pandemic? I mean, yes, we agree this is an epidemic. Is this a pandemic? Well, this map from the International Narcotics Control Board shows where most of the opioids are. Don't worry about the unit. It's just a unit. The red is really high amounts of opioids in those countries and they're distributed to those countries. White is obviously very low. And you might look at this and go, okay, Australia, Canada, the U.S., Germany, sure, you know, we're up there, and some of these other countries, not so much. Let me tell you, it's really an American problem. Okay, so here's some bullet points that highlight this fact. We constitute 4.6 of the world's population, and we consume 80% of the world's opioids. We consume 99% of the world's hydrocodone. There are enough prescribed opioids for each American to take a prescription opioid every 4 hours for a month. It's estimated that 2.1 million Americans, 1% of the country, or a little less than, with prescription opioid substance use disorder. And that was in 2012, probably higher now. And it's estimated that nearly 500,000 are addicted to heroin, and that was of 2012. Now, you might think we're number one in this, and therefore maybe we have superior outcomes in pain management. More opioids, right? We should have better pain management. Not at all. There is nothing that says, there's no outcome that has ever demonstrated we have better pain control in this country. And we're going to talk about why that is and how actually ineffective opioids can be for pain. So how did we get here? Well, it started with this plan. Anyone know what this is called? Yeah. Anyone know the Latin term? Papaverum somniferum, sleep-inducing. Yes. If you look at this goo that's oozing out, they excoriated the outside. This goo actually has morphine and codeine right there. Okay? The entire history of humankind has intermingled with this plant. Okay? There have been fossils of poppy seeds with the Neanderthals found in lake beds in Switzerland. You go back 3,400 BCE, the Sumerians called it the joy plant, cuneiform. It was written in their stone. Homer talked about it in the Odyssey. And up until 1809 was the first time we actually took that plant, isolated morphine. Frederick Saturner, a German. The next 200 years was really the medicalization of that plant. So as I mentioned, morphine was isolated, and soon after, codeine. In the mid-19th century, we got the hypodermic needle. So no longer do we use salves or take it orally, but now we had this new route of administration, which originally was subcutaneous, and then it was intramuscular, and then, of course, over time, intravenous. In 1898, heroin was synthesized. And we're going to talk about it. It was actually developed to be a non-addictive opioid. That's why they wanted to develop it. Soon afterwards, after World War I, there was an explosion in opioids. Basically, there are two schools of thought. One is you took a parent molecule and you modified it. You changed a reactive group. Those are the semi-synthetic opioids. Or you created an entirely new substance, molecule. And those are called the synthetic opioids. Right in the red here, you can see right after heroin was synthesized, it spread like wildfire in countries throughout the world. It was estimated that 2/3 of Americans at one point were addicted to heroin. That was just an estimate. And you can see soon afterwards, the U.S. Pure Food and Drug Act was initiated, which really started the wheels turning heroin into an illegal substance. And it wasn't until the Harrison Narcotic Act that that really became true. And fast forward to 1970, the Controlled Substances Act, where we developed our DEA schedules on what is illegal and what might have medical use. In 1973, we discovered how these drugs might actually work. Now, there had been some research before and certainly afterwards. But we realized, not until really just 43 years ago, that these drugs that humans have been using for thousands of years actually have these receptors, and they do certain things. And we identified the mu, the delta, the kappa, and the nociceptin receptor. And we understood then that we actually develop our own opioids. We don't need the poppy to develop our own opioids. So if I stubbed my toe on this podium, I actually release my own endogenous opioid system to address that pain. So endorphin is for mu, and you can see the term endo inside morphine, endorphin. And then the others, the exogenous agonists obviously are some of the commonly used opioids we have in medicine, morphine, methadone, fentanyl. And then we have antagonists. So just 40 years of understanding how these things work. And then we realize these receptors are throughout our body and they control lots of different functions. So you might be thinking opioids and pain. But they actually do a lot more than that. They're involved in, obviously, GI motility, your respiratory drive, psychotic features, feeding, sedation, and hormones like prolactin and growth hormone. They affect everything. And so when you think about some of the side effects we're going to talk about later, long-term with the use of opioids, it all comes back to this. We knew this was possible. And we even have our genes encoding for beta endorphin. So the pro-opio-melanocortin basically exists in all vertebrates. And beta endorphin is one of the end molecules that's derived from this gene. So clearly, we have this system built within us. We use that poppy plant exogenously to augment that system. Moving on from 1973, with this understanding, we started applying opioids in other places, like the epidural space. Drugs started to change. We developed MS-Contin in 1984, OxyContin in 1996. In the 80s and 90s, The World Health Organization had their cancer pain relief guidelines. The American Pain Society came up with the fifth vital sign in 1996. I'm going to talk about all this. Hospice care was growing in favor. The Joint Commission and Veterans Affairs adopted pain as the fifth vital sign. And then the explosion really took off. And in 2007, we're going to talk about the Purdue Pharma lawsuit. And in the last 15 years, this is what we're dealing with. This is in the backdrop. 2007, the CDC did raise concerns about what was happening. 2010, the International Association for the Study of Pain basically said access to pain management is a human right. Just 2 years ago, the DEA changed the acetaminophen-containing opioids from Schedule 2 from Schedule 3. And then just this week, just 2 days ago, the CDC published their first national guidelines in opioid prescribing. It was a big event that just happened 2 days ago. You might be asking yourself, well, I hear people talk about opiate and opioid and narcotics, so I just want to clear the air with the definitions. Opiate is specific for the naturally occurring alkaloids like morphine or codeine. So those are the molecules that are directly coming from the plant. Those are opiates. Opioids refer to all of the drugs or molecules that act at opioid receptors, hence why we're using opioid for the name of this talk. And then narcotic, which historically has been used in medicine for sleep-inducing. We've really shifted that term, especially in the 90s, towards the legal realm for enforcement, for police departments, for the DEA, so that we describe a narcotic as an illegal substance. Obviously, we're not prescribing illegal substances. And so we as physicians or healthcare providers choose to use opioid. If we're talking about an illegal substance like heroin, we might call that a narcotic. So let's talk about this DEA schedule. It's kind of interesting. It was out of the Controlled Substance Act in 1970. And Schedule 1 is really the narcotic class, the illegal drugs. And some examples here are heroin, marijuana, and PCP. Schedule 2, as you can see, based on this schedule, it has medical use and high addiction potential. Those are some of the commonly used opioids we have here. And then going down, you can see there, based on the schedule, there's moderate and then there's low abuse potential. But some of you are probably going, wait, there's some weird things here. And over time, these drugs shift. And a lot of this is based on lobbies. So let's take marijuana, for example. Okay, it certainly has medical uses, right? We can talk about its use for analgesia, for nausea, for chemotherapy-induced nausea, for appetite stimulation in HIV/AIDS patients, etc. It's been used in medicine for quite a long time. We're obviously probably going to move there in the next 5 to 10 years, certainly nationally, if not statewide soon. What's interesting is it's been labeled as a high addiction potential drug. Actually, you talk to most addictionologists, it's very low on the list. Not to say you can't become addicted to it. I'm not saying that at all. But compared to heroin or nicotine or alcohol, it's far less, actually. And then let's take the Schedule 4, the benzodiazepines. Low abuse potential. As a pain physician, I can tell you absolutely not. High abuse potential. And we're going to talk about the sister silent epidemic of benzodiazepine-related deaths. Oh, good question. So Ativan, lorazepam, diazepam or Valium, Xanax, alprazolam. So all the drugs you might use for anxiety or for sleep, commonly. And we're going to talk about those in just a bit. So this is my little blurb. If a human took a dose of something and it had a response, that infers that that person has some sort of system that obviously is affected by that substance. So there's got to be a reason for it. So if humans throughout history have been grabbing the poppy or whatever, and they derive some benefit, obviously there must be some sort of inherent system. We're not eating daffodils on a regular basis because there's not much of an effect other than maybe getting nauseous, right? But we might have grabbed willow bark and used that and noticed, oh, it helps my pain, and I noticed that I bleed a little bit more easily, and willow bark, aspirin. So obviously we have been trying substances in nature and medicalizing them, and I'm going to talk about that in just a second. And this concept is very old. This gentleman, Paracelsus, 500 years ago, the father of toxicology, in his Latin there, dosis facit venenum, which translates to the dose makes the poison. It's not the drug. We're going to talk about a lot of things like, oh, they're bad. Not necessarily. It's really the dose that matters, because I could theoretically kill someone with water. I could kill someone with air. But I could heal someone with alcohol. I could heal someone with heroin, believe it or not. So it's really not just the drug itself, but it's how it's used and the dose. So here are some examples from nature. If you can recognize these, I'm very proud of you. You deserve a botany degree. So in the upper left-hand corner is cocaine. And you can see below is peyote, then grain alcohol or the mash there. You saw the papaverum somniferum, and below is marijuana. And people will classify these groups of drugs as stimulants or uppers, hallucinogenics, sedatives and downers, opioids and cannabinoids. And, well, look, we use all of these medically. We use cocaine as a local anesthetic. We don't use methamphetamine, but we'll use methylphenidate for attention and wakefulness. We'll use ketamine for anesthesia. People have used LSD or studying LSD for post-traumatic stress disorder. Ketamine is being studied for depression. Clearly, barbiturates and benzodiazepines have been used in anesthesia, for anxiety, for sedation. Morphine, obviously, all these things, analgesia, diarrhea, and cough. Marijuana, as I mentioned, for nausea, appetite, and analgesia. So all these substances, you can either say we use them medically or vilify them and say they're this illegal drug. There's usually two sides to the coin. So that whole DEA schedule is a bit arbitrary, wouldn't you agree? I mean, we can take almost any one of those narcotics in Schedule 1 and use them medically. For example, heroin is used in the United Kingdom medically, okay, not just as an illicit substance. So let's talk about heroin. It was synthesized in 1874, developed in 1898, as I mentioned, and it really was invented with the goal of providing analgesia without causing addiction. People understood very early on that it was an addictive substance, however. And the term comes from strong, heroic, as you might imagine. The majority of heroin these days comes from what's called the Golden Crescent, Afghanistan, Iran, and the Golden Triangle, Burma, Thailand, Vietnam, Mexico, and Colombia. It's considered right now to be the most addictive substance on Earth. And I'll show you this table, which was published in 2007 in The Lancet. And what Dr. Nutt did was he took 20 experts, addictionologists, and he just grouped 20 substances that had addictive potential. And he had them rate, based on physical harm, dependence, and social harm, all of these drugs. And by far and away, heroin was number one. And you can talk to people who are addicted to these substances or addicted to multiple substances, and you get the same discourse, that heroin is the vice that clenches people in. This is the short definition from the American Society of Addiction Medicine. There's a much longer definition on their website. But you can see here addiction is a primary chronic disease of brain reward, motivation, memory, and related circuitry. Dysfunction in these circuits leads to characteristic biological, psychological, social, and spiritual manifestations. This is reflected in an individual pathologically pursuing reward and or relief by substance use and other behaviors. Addiction is characterized by inability to consistently abstain, impairment in behavioral control, craving, which I've underlined, diminished recognition of significant problems with one's behaviors and interpersonal relationships, and a dysfunctional emotional response. Like other chronic diseases, addiction often involves cycles of relapse and remission. Without treatment or engagement in recovery activities, addiction is progressive and can result in disability or premature death. Okay. Now, some of you may be very familiar with this definition, but there's some very important words. One I highlighted here, chronic. So this isn't something that just goes away. You don't just treat someone for their addiction and it goes away. It's a lifelong disease. You manage it. And I've highlighted what historically we've called the four C's, craving, compulsion, control, and consequences. So what that gets to is you might have a craving for that substance. You compulsively think about it or act around it or change your schedule to do something for it. You lose control in your other daily activities, whether it's picking up your children from school or doing your work-related activities. And then you use despite consequences. And that's the biggest harm there. Now, we all have aspects of this reward system in ourselves. So you can't just say, you know, that person's an addict and that person's not. This is a dysfunction reward. And it's a very interesting interplay between genetics and environment that creates these settings for addiction. And what I really want to get or drive home is that there's a very fine line between who is an addict and who is a non-addict, okay? It's very difficult to determine who that is preemptively, and you shouldn't assume a lot of the things that we often do. The estimated risk of addiction when taking chronic opioid therapy, highly variable, 2 to 30% looking at several different studies. We don't really know, but it's there. And some people back in the 90s said, oh, it's a very low addiction potential. It's not going to be an issue. Whereas others were saying, no, it's going to be quite high. So it's quite controversial, and it's very difficult to tease this out. And just eliminating a substance, I think you all understand, will not eliminate addiction. Reducing prescribed opioids, which is our goal, will likely lead to the next thing. We have to keep that in mind. And this is a chronic disease and needs chronic care. So we're going to talk about what the future holds for us. So I'm going to briefly run through major influences on why we're in this epidemic. So the rise of big pharma, Purdue Pharmaceuticals, you might have heard it, 1996 developed OxyContin. The problem was they marketed it as less addictive, abuse resistant. And in 2007, they had to pay $600 million in a fine, in a lawsuit. A few years later, they came up with their abuse deterrent OxyContin, which is much more difficult to abuse. Now, don't feel sorry for them because you might think, well, $600 million is a lot of money. Well, in 2015, in 1 year, they had made $3 billion. And Forbes magazine, Richest American Families, the Sackler family, which owns 100% of Purdue, was number 16 on that list. And $35 billion in revenue since 1995, most of that from OxyContin. That's interesting because his older brother, Arthur Sackler, was also a psychiatrist, the tumor psychiatrist, and he was the gentleman who introduced the idea of advertising directly to physicians in the early 60s. And he is credited with making diazepam, or Valium, the first $100 million drug in the United States. It was the most prescribed drug between 1969 and 1982. And if you were a physician looking in a JAMA in 1970, this is the ad you would have seen. Her world orbits around doctors. Psychic tension rules her universe. And what they describe is the story of this widow and all these doctors surrounding her, looking at her in consternation, her mother, her older sister, and they draw a circle, this sociological diagram of the father who's deceased. Now, some of you might be thinking this is strange. Others of you might be thinking, well, I see all these ads all the time. It's true. You do see all these ads all the time nowadays. In 1997, the FDA allowed expansion of direct-to-consumer marketing. I remember I was in high school and I started seeing these ads for drugs with all those side effects and consequences, and I was like, this is really strange. Just in 2000, if you look at how much pharmaceutical companies spent on certain aspects of direct-to-consumer marketing, just in samples, $8 billion almost. Direct-to-consumer marketing was $2.5 billion. And physician detailing, $4 billion. You might be asking what that is. That's payment to physicians. That's via lectures, continuing medical education, promotions, food, gifts, etc. Was there a conflict of interest? You make the call. We needed transparency. So with the passing of the Affordable Care Act in 2010, Obama also signed the Physician Payment Sunshine Act. So you can look up any physician. You can look me up right now and see what kind of money has been given. Now, obviously, there are people who get money for lots of reasons, research, et cetera, putting on lectures, et cetera. But it's the people who are obviously making hundreds of thousands of dollars, going to Hawaii for weeks, et cetera, that you want to highlight. So this is now very transparent. The public can look this up. So what is the American patient-doctor relationship today? Well, it doesn't look too much like what Norman Rockwell painted in The Doctor and the Doll in 1929. If we look at the patient-doctor relationship today, it's very unique being in this country. It's a very special relationship. I have the ability to understand and get to know patients very well. I have the almost freedom to do mostly what I want to do. I'm not restricted by certain drugs or formulary to some degree. I do have to answer to an insurer who pays for those medications or devices or procedures, and certainly we negotiate how that works. But in other countries, as you imagine, the payer is right in between. Doctors really can't prescribe whatever they want. If there's an issue, the government or that payer is going to determine what is going to be given. And that payer or the government is also worried about what other patients and what other doctors are going through. They're thinking about society as a whole. And while there might be a lot of restrictions and barriers to that way of healthcare, there are some issues with not understanding the societal consequences of what we do between patient and doctor in this country. Managed care in the 1990s and all the way through today really reduced our length of stay with our patient visits. You go back 30, 40 years ago, you could spend quite a bit of time. Now the average length with a primary care provider is 13 minutes. It's not very much time to talk about opioids, all the risks, all the benefits. I'm spending an hour with you going through all this stuff. Imagine me just first getting to know people, what's wrong, and then finally talking about these drugs. As you can imagine, a lot of physicians just make the conversation shorter by writing a prescription. Here you go. have a good day. And they don't dive in to all the risks and benefits that are necessary. And then, of course, in the last 10 to 20 years, we've had patient satisfaction surveys, the Prescani scores, the HCAHPS. And some people, some physicians think, well, if I want to keep my patients happy, I'm being rated, I'm being judged, my payment comes from that, I should give them something for that. I should give them a prescription. Now, obviously, I don't agree with that at all, but there are people who feel that way. The World Health Organization's cancer ladder, introduced in 1986. What that ladder was basically saying, let's start with a non-opioid, mild analgesic, and then work our way up to a mild opioid and then to a strong opioid. The original intention of this ladder was to promote the use of pain medications for cancer pain in areas that did not. Okay? It even reads, it needs to be emphasized that the relief is possible for several million cancer patients who each day suffer unalleviated pain. Analgesic drug therapy is an essential component of this approach. When used correctly, it is capable of controlling pain in more than 90% of patients. And that's true, actually. With subsequent studies, we found that 80% of patients benefited from this simple ladder. But the original rationale was not for the United States. It wasn't for Australia. It wasn't for Germany. It was for those countries in white and light purple, like sub-Saharan Africa, like India, which even to this day still do not treat their cancer patients who are suffering until their deaths. So we've seen the cancer ladder that's used for pain used for non-cancer pain, both chronic and acute. And there's some major issues with that as they escalate all the way up to opioids, freedom from pain, and continue to escalate there. The fifth vital sign, you probably heard this term. It was introduced by President James Campbell of the American Pain Society in 1996. And he said if pain were assessed with the same zeal as other vital signs, and they're listed here, it would have a much better chance of being treated properly. We need to train doctors and nurses to treat pain as a fifth vital sign or as a vital sign. And certainly the VA and the Joint Commission adopted this idea. And it's a great idea. It's an important idea. But what did it lead to is not exactly what Dr. Campbell wanted. Okay, yes, it's important to assess pain, but if you did have a moderate or severe score, what were you going to do about it? And a lot of the times the answer was an opioid. And then the hospice movement, which I'm not going to obviously go through the entire history, was growing in the 1990s, through the 2000s and to today, end of life, dying with dignity. All this where you were seeing patients getting opioids at the end of their life, and that might have loosened the liberal idea of using opioids in other situations. The intentions of all this, I'm not denigrating either of these ideas. These are fantastic ideas. The intentions were fantastic. Improve awareness, reduce suffering. But how that played out over time, all these influences really affected what we're seeing today. And then I put this in red because this is what gets me going the most. If the number of hours devoted to pain education in American medical schools over 4 years, what do you guys think that is? Just throw out some numbers. 20. Anyone else? Over 4 years, just 20 hours. 9. Canada, more than double. So if we take into account the education you've had on pain from Dr. Schumacher, Pullins, Poré, Reddy, DePinto, and myself, you will have received, if you all came every time, 6 hours of didactics and 3 hours of Q&A, 9 hours. You guys have graduated medical school in the United States. So congratulations. But this has got to change, okay? Why do we use opioids for pain? Well, if there was a better option, we'd use it, frankly. If there was a magic pill that didn't have any side effects and addressed pain really well, we'd use it. We wouldn't have this issue. But here's what we've got. We only have so many drugs at our disposal, and each one of those drugs has their own set of side effects. So where do we go? And for many people, it's just easier to give the one opioid rather than trying to balance the side effects with acetaminophen, with the side effect of ibuprofen, with the side effect of some other neuropathic pain drug. But here are some options for people. And there were some myths that were even taught to me when I was a medical student. And number one was there's no ceiling effect with opioids. Now, what is a ceiling effect? Well, a ceiling effect is, for example, Tylenol, acetaminophen. You can only get so much relief out of it, right? You're not going to have an amputation of your foot and say, keep on taking this Tylenol, you're going to get better. Obviously, that doesn't work. Tylenol can only give you so much relief. And similarly, ibuprofen can only give you so much relief. But if you get an opioid, we can keep on giving it to you until finally you're more comfortable. So that is true. And originally, we thought there was no ceiling effect with opioids. But that was when we were using doses much smaller than what we use today. So there is a ceiling, but it's a really, really high ceiling. In 2016, Dr. Schumacher every day see the ceiling effect in opioids. We are pouring opioids. I mean, we're almost running out of the stock, and patients are still sitting there, I have 9 out of 10 pain. I have 10 out of 10 pain. So they've developed significant tolerance, but we've reached that ceiling. We can't do much more for patients. And so there is a myth. Yes, you can go up and up to a certain degree, but at some point you can't, okay? And so we need to keep that in mind. There are other options. We've been told that opioids are the most effective treatment for pain. In certain situations, yeah. So for acute pain, breakthrough pain, cancer pain, we've talked about certain situations, yes. But their use in chronic non-cancer pain is controversial. They're useful for static pain, meaning when you're staying still. They're not useful for when you move. There are a lot of individual variabilities in how the drugs work. And we're still using this trial and error method to figure out how if a drug works well for you. Oh, did that hydrocodone work for you? Oh, no, it didn't. Let's try this oxycodone. Oh, that didn't. Let's try morphine. We don't have a genetic test. We're working on it. We don't have a genetic test to say this is going to work best for you. Personalized medicine. We want that. Hopefully we'll have that. But hopefully we don't need opioids at all. Maybe we'll have something else. And COX inhibitors or cyclooxygenase inhibitors, also called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen or Celebrex, they're actually the most effective in acute pain. Okay, we always fall back on opioids, but this Oxford League Table of Analgesic Efficacy ordered from number one at the top, which is a drug you can't even get in this country. It's a torcoxib, but it's related to Celebrex if you're familiar with that drug. But you can see like the first eight or so are all those COX inhibitors or NSAIDs. The dark blue are the opioids. And this is based on number needed to treat. And so that's how many people you need to give this drug to until one person says, I have a 50% reduction in my pain. Okay, and the lowest NNT is a torcoxib at those doses. And now you might ask, well, what about chronic pain? Well, here's an interesting Danish study. And they found that in Denmark, they use opioids quite a bit as well. And they found that the odds of recovery from chronic pain were almost four times higher among individuals not using opioids compared with individuals using opioids. And they found that use of strong opioids was associated with poor health-related quality of life. And the results indicated that individuals with chronic pain using strong opioids had a higher risk of death than individuals without chronic pain at all. So very interesting. And then myth number three, you just have to worry about the acute side effects. The respiratory depression I mentioned, the nausea, the itching, the hives, the constipation. I was never taught about any of this stuff on the right as a medical student. How many of you know that men who are taking chronic opioids have low testosterone levels? Yeah, one raise of hand. And, you know, 5 years later, you meet them for the very first time. They've been on all these opioids for 5 years. Do you have low libido? Do you have decreased energy? Yeah, I do. Check their testosterone. Zero. Opioids affect, as we talked about, everything. It's not just pain. Now, we're going to go through a couple other topics, specifically hyperalgesia, which is this, opioid-induced hyperalgesia. And this is the notion that opioids actually make you more sensitive to pain. Totally paradoxical. And the first clinical concept was recognized by anesthesiologists working with an opioid called remifentanil. And it's an opioid that metabolizes extremely quickly. So we can use it when we need it, and we can stop it, and basically within minutes it's gone. Well, when we used it, we noticed that patients in the recovery room were screaming in severe, significant pain. Further animal studies determined that, yes, indeed, there is this hyperalgesic response afterwards. And moving beyond remifentanil, we found that pretty much any opioid has that response. We see it most dramatically when the drug has a fast offset or use high doses or use it for a long period of time. But we see this quite frequently. Opioid-induced hyperalgesia is a real phenomenon. There are a lot of papers about it. I think the medical community is slowly grasping the idea, and it's very difficult to objectively determine when one has it, but you put an IV in a heroin addict who's been on opioids for a long period of time, someone who puts needles in themselves all the time, and they're screaming bloody murder when you're trying to put an IV in, which is not a fun task, but they have an augmented response to it. To me, that's stating that this patient has hyperalgesia or increased sensitivity to their pain. And it is the reason I do not recommend opioids personally for chronic non-cancer pain. Now, there may be exceptions, of course, don't get me wrong, but in general, I try to not use opioids for non-cancer chronic pain. because I don't want to make their pain worse over time. And that Danish study basically showed that as well. Here's an interesting concept which might be newer on your radar, the idea that opioids may play a role in cancer, tumor regrowth and recurrence. So an article in 2006 looked at regional anesthesia where they were able to reduce the amount of opioids women after mastectomy were getting, and they noticed that those who got the regional anesthesia and also had reduced opioid consumption had a lower recurrence rate and metastatic rate. It was kind of an interesting idea. And then this book was published in the last few years from Perot. And the idea is that opioids play a role in tumor cell invasion and angiogenesis, et cetera. And so it's a very interesting idea. Now, I can't say that one leads to the other. I'm not saying that at all. But there is something to this that we need to study and figure out. And it may change the way we actually address cancer pain in the future. So how do we reconcile that patient-doctor relationship when it comes to opioids with all of these risks with such a short amount of time? So we've been using opioid patient-provider agreements. They're not contracts anymore. The contracts sound so obligatory and denouncing. We try to spend as much time as we can talking about risks and benefits, but it's really difficult. If we only have 13 minutes, the message has to come from not us. We don't have the time, frankly. It's got to come from somewhere else, and we'll talk about some of those ways, whether it's the public discourse, advertising, billboards, commercials, etc. We try to figure out who are at risk and who is not at risk for addiction or abuse or misuse. And we have these tools, the SOAP, the CALM, and we have pain psychologists like Dr. Pullins who help us out, who help us understand who might be at higher risk. And it's not to say that patients with a history of substance abuse or who have a psychiatric history do not deserve opioids. That's not at all what I'm saying. But we may have to figure out a way in which we reduce the risk in those individuals. 49 states in this union have a prescription drug monitoring program. That's a program where pharmacists and physicians and healthcare providers can figure out which drugs have been prescribed where from a patient. Missouri has their bill going through legislation right now, so hopefully they'll join all 50. And we have incorporated urine drug screens because even if you trust your patient to death, you don't know what they're doing with it necessarily. So urine drug screens may confirm they're not taking that drug and they're going off and selling it, who knows, or giving it to family or friends. Or they are taking it. And then where to return unused drugs? How many of you had a surgery, had a dentist procedure, they give you a bottle of opioids, you don't use them, and you're sitting with them on your medicine shelf? Yeah, I got a huge bottle of Vicodin after my wisdom teeth. I just had it for years, and I always thought to myself, well, if I have pain at some point, I guess I got that, right? I think we all do that to some degree. We never really tell someone, you know what, if you're not going to use them, get rid of them in this way. Well, now we have to. This was a difficult issue. So only a few years ago, you had to go to a police station to return these drugs because they didn't want people with other ideas robbing pharmacies. But we're trying to change that so there's more access to returning your old drugs. And I heard recently that all Walgreens nationally are going to try to create a program where you can return your drugs. And right now in California, there's a website where you can look up pharmacies where you can return your drugs. Police stations are still an option for you. And then locking up drugs at home, because guess what? There are children, there are grandchildren, and others who may take your drugs, so we encourage locks. Don't give them to anyone else. Don't combine with other drugs. And then access to a drug called naloxone, which reverses the effects of all these drugs, can save lives. And you might find it in these packages like this, where it's administered intranasally. Or there's this Evzio, which you basically hit the button and it gives you an injection to the side of your thigh. For those of you who have an EpiPen, for example, might be familiar with this kind of, delivery. We're trying to move naloxone into any and every grocery store and drugstore around the country. Because you might think, well, aren't we promoting, more bad behavior? Well, we've gone through this before with needle exchange programs. No, it turns out it's a lot safer. And if we can save somebody, obviously, that's the goal. And so we're trying to create more access. And physicians are starting to prescribe and give patients naloxone every time they give them an opioid. And it's highly encouraged. Here's our patient-provider agreement. I can show you that another time. But for the purposes of time, I'll keep on moving. We also go through our opioid equivalence table to determine how much opioid a patient is on. And I want to highlight another emerging issue, and that is pregnant women. A study out of anesthesiology found that 1 out of 7 pregnant women are prescribed an opioid. A lot of physicians, gynecologists, obstetricians, and others have stated, well, the risk for congenital malformation associated with opioids appears low. and it's not that I don't care about congenital malformations. I mean, obviously that's a concern. But what I'm concerned about is what are we doing to the development of the endogenous opioid system? How is that baby going to develop their reward, their pain management, all those endocrine issues that we're seeing? So this is not a light issue at all, in my opinion. And we don't have enough data. It's a very hard topic to study. But you can see year after year, the increased number of babies born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, where they're basically having withdrawal symptoms as soon as they're born because their mother was on an opioid. And there's a Reuters, in fact, small video documentary that you can look at, which they'll literally show you the videos of these babies. And it's really interesting to take a look at. The sister silent epidemic is, as I mentioned, the benzodiazepine epidemic. So it almost shadows the opioid epidemic. And in most cases where an opioid is related to death, there's another substance, whether it's alcohol, whether it's a benzodiazepine. Those are those Xanax, Ativans, Valiums, Libriums, all those drugs that can be used for sleep or for anxiety. And I put the cocaine graph here just in case you think, well, is our whole country going down the toilet? Is like, are we just using everything more now? No, not necessarily. I mean, cocaine's quite an illicit drug, but it's kind of going through its ups and downs. It's really opioids and benzodiazepines that's really going up and up. And those are prescribed drugs. And, you know, obviously sleep is a major health issue, but benzodiazepines are not the answer. They actually make things worse, just like opioids can make things worse for your pain. There's that endogenous, exogenous system, so that when you take something from outside, it changes the way your body deals with those issues. And the respiratory depression from opioids plus a benzodiazepine is synergistic. So there's a high risk of respiratory depression and death when you combine these drugs. We need psychiatrists, we need sleep specialists to help us with this issue. It's a separate issue. So if we in the medical community start to limit the access of opioids to individuals, which is encouraged, it will lead to a number of individuals to turn to illicit opioids, including heroin. I do think we're going to see a plateau and dip in prescribed opioid-related deaths. I do predict there's going to be an increase in heroin-related deaths. I do. And we've seen this in Washington State, where they mandated that patients taking over 120 oral morphine equivalents had to see a pain physician. This started about 5 years ago. And sure enough, they saw a reduction in prescribed opioid-related deaths, but an uptick in heroin-related deaths. So we have to be ready. We can't just throw out the CDC guidelines and assume everything's going to get better. The FDA is encouraging abuse deterrent drugs. They may help, but they're not the answer, because if you're addicted, you're going to find the next thing, right? We have OxyContin, the abuse deterrent version, but you find the next thing. And you might think like drugs like methadone, Suboxone, which are used for opioid maintenance. There are people abusing those very drugs. So this is not an easy problem. And then the war on drugs, incarcerating individuals for these issues, didn't work. It doesn't work. It's a chronic disease. So you lock someone up, they get out, they go back to it, you lock them up again. It's a vicious cycle, right? So we have to move towards treatment. It's a chronic problem. Needle exchange programs have been used in Vancouver, British Columbia, and Canada for heroin addicts to reduce bloodborne pathogen diseases. It might seem like it's promoting a bad habit, but it actually has led to a decrease in mortality. And then, as I mentioned, naloxone access. Here are the CDC guidelines, which were just introduced a couple days ago. Obama, more than a month ago, proposed $1.1 billion for treatment of those addicted to opioids. So obviously he's been told, President, we're going to have issues with heroin in the next few years. We better be ready. And that's where this money is earmarked for. And so states are asking for it. We've gone through an epidemic to some degree with smoking, if you may recall, in the last 30 years or so. And we had to address this in many different ways: provider education, public awareness, legislation, patient access and education, disruptive technology. Think about what we've done with smoking. You can't smoke in a bar or restaurant anymore. You look at the packages, they have these disgusting pictures or labels all over them. The taxes are extremely high. The visibility of smoking entertainment has been reduced. San Francisco, we're going to increase the minimum age from 18 to 21 on June 1st. The access to programs to help you quit smoking is everywhere. There are billboards, they're in doctor's offices, and we're screening. We're asking doctors to screen. And look at some of these labels from other countries as well. It's had a major impact on smoking. And here's some graphs of smoking in the United States and in the UK. And look, in the last 20 years, we've made a huge dent in smoking. I wouldn't say this is a victory. We're not there yet. We have still a ways to go. But we actually turned this thing around. The annual consumption of cigarettes really peaked around the 80s here, And we've seen, even in our young adolescents, high school students, peaking in the mid-90s and now coming back down even below our general population. So it is possible. And I would look to smoking as sort of our precedent to figure out how we deal with our opioid epidemic. Well, firstly, we can't think pain should be treated with opioids. That's not going to work, because pain is a very complex issue. It involves biological, psychological, and social issues. Okay, and George Engel came up with this idea. And the very definition of pain from the IESP is that it's an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience. You can't just throw a drug at it and say, good luck, you're going to be fine. It's a very complex problem, and we need people who understand this. I'm sure you've seen these data before. The IOM says there are 116 million Americans who have chronic pain, $635 billion, and that's more than the combined cost of heart disease, diabetes, and cancer. It's a major issue, and opioids are clearly not the answer. This is a book I encourage you all to read. It's fantastically written. Judy Foreman wrote it. Just came out a couple years ago. And in it, she describes the diffusion of responsibility, and I totally agree. If we look at even our own healthcare providers or physicians, look, we're all based on organ specialties. You are a heart doctor, you're a cardiologist, you're a gastroenterologist, you're a nephrologist. And then if we look at our generalists who are at the front lines of seeing our patients, as I told you, they only have 13 minutes, and in some clinics, 7 minutes. That's all they've got. They don't have enough time to deal with pain, the complexity of it, and how to address it. And now you might say, well, what about pain specialists? What about people like me? Well, it turns out there are only 3,000 to 4,000 of us in the United States, according to the American Academy of Pain Medicine, and that means there's only one for every 100,000 Americans, or one for every 33,000 patients in chronic pain. So the pain patients, 33,000. What about research? Well, the National Institutes of Health, well, if I wanted to do pain research, or you know, Dr. Schumacher, Dr. Basbaum, they all do this great research, but there's no National Institute of Pain. They have to apply through other avenues, so via brain or the National Institute of Drug Abuse. And so Judy Foreman asks, well, if this is such a problem, why don't we have a pain-only research institute? It's a very good point. And then the government itself, Health and Human Services, is broken down with the CDC, the FDA, the CMS, and then the enforcement aspect is the DEA. We're all sharing these issues. We're all doing our own thing. And so there's this idea of a diffusion of responsibility, like they'll take care of it, or that doctor says, yep, they'll take care of it. So everyone's sort of pointing fingers, and that's another reason why we are where we are. And as anyone knows, the way to deal with diffusion of responsibility is just say, we have to own it. We all have the responsibility. Whether you're a physician or just a citizen, you know, or your family member says, yeah, I've got these extra Vicodin, you can say, hey, you should take it to the pharmacy or the police department. Get rid of it. Just get rid of it. Don't have it available for your son or whoever else who may get curious. So we all have that responsibility. I just, with 1 minute left, want to thank Dr. Schumacher for giving me the opportunity to talk. I want to thank the CDC not only for publishing their guidelines, but we emailed back and forth over the last 4 months for these data, so those charts you see are really from them. I want to thank pain physicians, pain researchers, and authors who want to make a difference, because this is a really passionate topic, obviously. And here are three books I've highlighted during the talk, but also I'm going to add Melanie Thernstrom's The Pain Chronicles. She's a New York Times writer, and she talks about her own ordeal with chronic pain. And these three books are fantastic reads. You know, me looking at textbooks, medical journals, being able to read it from another's viewpoint is so helpful for helping patients. So, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.